studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. This is Uprising and I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's Wednesday, March 4th, 2015. Former General and CIA Director David Petraeus will avoid prison time for leaking classified information. We'll speak with Norman Solomon about the double standards at work. And actress Danielle Watts stars in a short film called Muted, which addresses the starkly disparate reactions from police and the media when a black child goes missing compared to a white child. She'll join us in studio. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Courtney Morris, Assistant Professor of African American and Women's Studies at Penn State University. Hi, Courtney.
Hi, Sonali.
Well, the fallout from yesterday's congressional address by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu continues to mount. Almost 60 congressmen and women boycotted the talk, an unprecedented move. House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi said, quote, "I was near tears throughout the prime minister's speech, saddened by the insult to the intelligence of the United States and saddened by the condescension toward our knowledge of the threat posed by Iran." President Obama pointed out that Netanyahu, quote, didn't offer any viable alternatives to negotiating with Iran. While he claimed he didn't want to worsen the partisan divide, the prime minister's speech seems to have done just that. Netanyahu is claiming that the talks that State Secretary John Kerry has had with Iranian representatives in Geneva would essentially ensure a nuclear weapons program. Meanwhile, Kerry and his Iranian counterpart wrapped up their meeting today announcing that while challenges remain, they have made a lot of progress. Iran has already rejected a U.S. request for a 10-year freeze on any nuclear development. Courtney, even if Netanyahu's speech was just political theater, do you think it's put the Obama administration on the defensive? And could it influence the U.S. to take a more hawkish stand on Iran?
Well, based on President Obama's response to the speech, I think it actually just made him angry. And, you know, the way that he responded to Netanyahu's comments, he just systematically refuted every claim that Netanyahu made, which is essentially the idea that the United States, by engaging in these negotiations with Iran, is essentially going to give them the tools for the bomb. What the deal is designed to do, as you know, is to allow the U.S. to retain greater oversight over Iran's nuclear activities and to give international inspectors the leeway that they need to come in and to monitor Iran's nuclear capacities. And so Netanyahu's strategy of basically give them nothing unless they give us everything is not a viable strategy, and it's one that is assured to escalate the tensions between Iran and Israel and to possibly push us into war with Iran, which we don't want. That strategy didn't work for the Bush administration, and it won't work now. Now, on the other hand, it could empower certain legislators in the United States who are particularly hawkish and who may reject the whatever deal comes out of these negotiations, and that would be a mistake. Israel is really not versed in the art of diplomacy. And they tend to want to use unilateral military action to achieve their goals. That strategy won't work, and it won't make the United States or Israel safer. Mm-hmm. So it seems like President Obama is really going to stay the course on this one. Mm-hmm. But President Netanyahu's speech is definitely complicating things and not for the better.
The GOP-dominated House of Representatives passed funding for the Department of Homeland Security yesterday with no strings attached. Republicans had held hostage DHS funding over President Obama's executive action on immigration by separating the department's budget from the general budget last year. But the bid to force a DHS shutdown failed, with House Speaker John Boehner surrendering yesterday as all House Democrats held strong and voted to pass funding. 75 Republicans joined the vote. The capitulation came because Senate Democrats also refused to budge on the Senate version of the same bill. President Obama has vowed to immediately sign the funding bill into law. This won't be the last budget fight the GOP plans to launch in the coming months, as Tea Partier and Republican Representative John Fleming warned, quote, "there are more battles coming." Courtney, if the GOP had just left alone DHS funding last year, it would have had the same outcome as what just happened. How much of a waste of time and money is this party willing to engage in?
Well, Sonali, it seems like the GOP is prepared to waste quite a lot of the taxpayers' time and money on this kind of political grandstanding. And really, I think what we've learned from this is that Republicans are just making themselves look bad. This hurts them more than anyone. You know, I think what we've seen in this case is that the GOP, even though they have numerical control of Congress, they are not a unified party. And this is something that can really work in Democrats' favor, because we are seeing that John Boehner really does not have control of some of the more radical members of his party. And that there are real cracks in the GOP. And so I think what Democrats clearly are learning in this lesson is that even though they're a minority, if they unify as a party, they can really leverage those cracks in the GOP to push their own agenda forward and kind of watch the GOP implode from its own political infighting. So that's an encouraging sign. But as you said, this is only the first of many battles to come. And the Democrats are going to have a serious battle on their hands trying to move their own policies forward as Republicans continue to engage in these acts of kind of grandiose political theater.
And finally, the Justice Department released a report on policing in Ferguson, Missouri, that concluded that the city engages in a broad pattern of discrimination in policing. DOG investigators conducted hundreds of hours of interviews and combed through tens of thousands of police records. And they found that African Americans comprised 93% of all arrests, 85% of all drivers stopped, and got 90% of all citations between 2012 and 2014. The DOJ also found evidence of racial bias in private emails sent by Ferguson police. According to the New York Times, quote, minor, largely discretionary offenses such as disturbing the peace and jaywalking were brought almost exclusively against blacks. Last summer's fatal shooting of Michael Brown began over a jaywalking encounter. The DOJ has failed to bring federal charges against former officer Darren Wilson. Meanwhile, in Los Angeles, protests have continued over Sunday's shooting death of a Skid Row homeless African-American man who went by the name Africa and whose given name has been determined to be Charlie Satterman Robinet. Hundreds of people marched yesterday from Skid Row to LAPD's downtown headquarters to confront Chief Charlie Beck. Well, Courtney, what do you make of the DOJ's report, and can it force change in at least Ferguson?
Well, I think the DOJ report is it's encouraging. I mean, it really confirms what many of us have long suspected, which was that Michael Brown's killing last year was really just a symptom of a much, much deeper problem in Ferguson. And I think the findings really reveal how pervasive racism is in the criminal justice system in Ferguson and how black people are systematically targeted at every level of policing, from minor offenses to prosecution and sentencing. And I think the explicit racism that comes out in the report is shocking. I mean, there were a number of emails where officials use their government emails to circulate racist jokes about, black women should engage in abortions to reduce crime, comparing African Americans to monkeys, even joking about President Obama and saying that his presidency wouldn't last long because what black man can hold down a job for 4 years? And I think that kind of racist rhetoric really reveals how much that colors the way that these officials police black communities. And so I think these revelations will definitely lead the DOJ to pursue action against them.
Courtney Morris, thanks as always for joining us. We'll talk to you next week.
Bye, Sonali.
Courtney Morris is an assistant professor of African American and Women's Studies at Penn State University. We'll be right back. This is Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. You can now watch Uprising on Free Speech TV, which airs on Dish Network Channel 9415, DirecTV Channel 348, and on hundreds of part-time cable affiliates and on Roku. Former CIA head and decorated war general David Petraeus has just accepted a plea deal on federal charges of sharing classified information. Petraeus allegedly turned over several so-called black books to his biographer and girlfriend, Paula Broadwell, which contained secret information about the Afghanistan war, including code names, covert operatives, and more. The allegations first came to light in 2012 when Petraeus resigned from his position as CIA director. The case has dragged on since then. In order to avoid exposing the details of his relationship with Broadwell in a public trial, Petraeus has pled guilty. Together, he and the Justice Department have asked for 2 years probation and a $40,000 fine. The case stands in stark contrast to that of former CIA staffer Jeffrey Sterling, who in January was found guilty on 9 charges under the Espionage Act for apparently sharing with a journalist classified information about an ill-conceived CIA plan to thwart Iran's nuclear program. Sterling's sentencing hearing will be in April, and it's likely he faces a very long prison term. Meanwhile, NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden has indicated through a lawyer that he would like to return to the United States from his exile in Russia if he can be guaranteed a fair trial. Snowden also faces espionage charges. Laura Poitras's film about him, Citizen 4, recently won the Oscar for Best Documentary. And filmmaker Oliver Stone is now working on a film entitled Snowden, with actor Joseph Gordon-Levitt playing the role of the famous whistleblower. Joining me now is Norman Solomon, Executive Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, author of War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. He's co-founder of RootsAction.org and an editorial board member of ExposeFacts.org. Welcome to Uprising, Norman.
Hi, Sonali.
Now, is it fair to compare Petraeus' treatment in the legal system with Jeffrey Sterling, or are these apples and oranges?
Well, it's very fair to compare, and the treatment of both of these men really underscores the way in which the law functions so differently depending on one's station in life and whether one has powerful friends. Here we have one of the most celebrated, at least by the mass media generals of the last couple of generations, David Petraeus, who flagrantly violated the rules that he himself has proclaimed are sacrosanct about not disclosing to anyone any classified information. As a matter of fact, David Petraeus crowed about the need to punish another CIA whistleblower, John Kariakou, and told people publicly that it was essential to punish people who disclose classified information. And yet, as you just referred to, David Petraeus got, I don't even know if it was a slap on the wrist, maybe a little touch on the wrist. It's just a remarkably light plea deal agreement, which was inherently political. This is the Obama Justice Department cutting a deal and saying essentially, well, we could prosecute and quite likely have you sent to prison for years, but instead we're going to give you a small fine given your wealth, and you'll go on your merry way into corporate America to make yet more millions of dollars. Meanwhile, Jeffrey Sterling, a mid-level CIA case officer, formerly in that role, is now preparing for an April 24th sentencing, during which the Justice Department is expected to seek 20, 30 years in prison for disclosure of classified information.
I mean, you would imagine that David Petraeus, given that he was director of the CIA, should actually be held to a higher standard than a caseworker, right?
Yes, if anything, if the law were to be blind to social station or power and simply engage in prosecution and sentencing on the basis of the merits of the case. And having sat through every day of the 7 days of testimony in the Jeffrey Sterling trial back in late January, I find it very disturbing and upsetting, and it also makes me angry that in the last day we've gotten this news that General Petraeus is essentially getting off scot-free while Jeffrey Sterling is going to face apparently so many years in prison. There are other layers as well, because Jeffrey Sterling, as one of the few African-American case officers at the CIA, filed a racial discrimination complaint within the agency, and when he got nowhere, then filed an unprecedented into the federal court system lawsuit charging racial bias. And in fact, during the trial, the fact that he sought relief and a good outcome for himself through a racial discrimination lawsuit in the courts, that fact was repeatedly used against him by the prosecution to insinuate and sometimes come right out and say that he was angry, bitter, vindictive because he didn't get his way with the racial bias lawsuit, and that that was a motivation for him to allegedly disclose the classified information. So it was fed into and was fed by the prosecution as some kind of stereotypical angry black man who didn't get his way and tries to wreak havoc. And that was a major theme of the prosecution.
I'm really glad you brought up that point, Norman. I mean, obviously, there are a lot of issues at work here. Now, on this, on the fact that the Justice Department has, the same Justice Department that is asking for this barely slap on the wrist for David Petraeus is the Justice Department that has gone after Sterling, gone after James Risen, the New York Times journalist, gone after very aggressively whistleblowers and journalists using the Espionage Act. I understand that this act, a World War I or II era act, it has only been used 11 times, but seven of them under Obama's Justice Department?
That's right. Actually, until Obama came along, it had only been used three times. One of them against Daniel Ellsberg and Tony Russo in the Pentagon Papers case. And so we've had, you know, depending on how one counts it in terms of whistleblowing, eight or nine whistleblowers under the Obama administration who have been subjected to Espionage Act prosecution. It's a 98-year-old law passed during the repressive wave under President Wilson of World War I to try to stomp down on opposition to that horrible war. And so one of the things I think that we need to be very clear about in our own understanding and then in our public advocacy for change is that this is an inherently, flagrantly, subjectively political process. And outgoing Attorney General Eric Holder did a kind of victory lap speech at the National Press Club a couple of weeks ago, a farewell address at a luncheon of sorts, in which he exulted in his victory in the conviction of Jeffrey Sterling on the nine federal felony counts, including seven of them under the Espionage Act. And Holder said that this was a model for future prosecutions. He said it showed that we don't have to force journalists to testify as to the identity of their sources, and we can still get a conviction. And of course, it was the Justice Department that was dragged kicking and screaming away from its insistence that James Risen testify to identify a source in this case. And it's only because of the courage of James Risen and his support from many folks, journalistic outfits and others. And, you know, at rootsaction.org, we had a petition supporting James Risen. It's only because Risen and others put up a big fight that the Justice Department finally backed off. And yet now this is a new formula being put forward by the Attorney General to say, this is how you do it. This is how you imprison people who are whistleblowers, and you don't even necessarily have to raise the ire of the journalistic establishment. The problem, though, is, or one of the problems, is that this is an effort by the Obama administration to drive a wedge between independent, investigative-minded journalists and whistleblowers and the support for constituencies in each of those instances. And what we, I think, have to say very clearly and organize around is that you cannot meaningfully separate whistleblowing and journalism. They both need each other, and we refuse to allow a wedge to be successfully driven between the two in terms of supporting whistleblowing and supporting journalism.
Norman, back to the standards by which David Petraeus was treated in the legal system. I understand there is precedence for letting CIA directors off lightly. There was another CIA head, John Deutsch, Dutch Deutsch, who was also facing charges of sharing classified information in the 1990s and was pardoned at the last minute by President Clinton on his last day in office. And it seems as though the higher your position is, the less likely you are to be punished. I mean, CIA directors can leak information, but others can't.
We have a lot of instances in that way. You know, Leon Panetta, former CIA director, as well as former defense secretary, not only gave classified information to a film producer about the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, but also he himself, Panetta, has come out with a book that he refused to submit to the Publications Review Board of the CIA for vetting. And so here you have a former CIA director saying, oh, well, I don't have to follow these rules. I put out a book and it doesn't have to be looked at all by the very board set up within the CIA for this kind of situation. In stark contrast, Jeffrey Sterling, who wanted to write a book about the CIA, carefully went through the publications review board process. And in fact, that was part of the testimony that supposedly he was angry that it was taking so long and it was such a slow process. So Sterling goes through the process and that's used against him. And Panetta ignores the process and he's cashing checks totaling millions of dollars for his work as an author.
And I should mention, you said also earlier, Petraeus is, you know, essentially going to be making his millions. He's working for a private consulting firm right now. He's speaking events all over the country. Let's turn to another person who's facing espionage charges and would certainly be prosecuted under those were he to be in the United States, and that's Edward Snowden. He may be the biggest prize of all for this Justice Department if he shows up within the next couple of years. And he just revealed through a lawyer that he certainly wants to come back home if he can be guaranteed a fair trial. And I'm wondering if he can ask for the David Petraeus treatment. I'd like the Petraeus special, please. What are the odds that he would be ever guaranteed a fair trial?
Well, of course, you know, ever is a long time. But from here to the horizon, I'd say the odds are somewhere between very slim to none.
Yeah.
Of course, it is appropriate to ask for conditions that would amount to a fair trial, but not only because I've sat through the Jeffrey Sterling Espionage Act trial, but just on the facts of the record, it's unfortunately inconceivable that given this administration, this Justice Department, and the court system as it currently functions, that it would be possible for Snowden to come home and get a fair trial. Under the Espionage Act, the motivations for providing public information are not allowed into the courtroom for a jury to hear. And that in itself makes impossible a coherent defense.
Now, how important you think is it for there to be public attention on these issues? I mean, Edward Snowden is definitely somebody, a whistleblower who is very well known. He's a household name in the United States. The fact that Laura Poitras's documentary just won an Oscar, do you think that that shows a more sympathetic public, that in the court of public opinion he has been vindicated, and that that could possibly influence any legal decision?
I think one of the difficulties faced by the Obama administration and sort of the bipartisan national security quasi-consensus among the powerful in Washington, something very disturbing to those sectors is how much popular support Snowden gained and has retained in the last, almost 2 years now since he went public and the revelations from his NSA documents began. Despite the vilification, you know, terms like traitor and coward used by Vice President Biden and Secretary of State Kerry, who said that Snowden should, quote, man up, unquote, and come home and face the legal music. I don't know what man up compared to woman up is supposed to mean. But in point of fact, we've had this barrage of condemnation and slander against Snowden coming from the administration and much of the media punditocracy. And yet, if you look at the polling numbers, of course, depending on how the question is asked, even that sort of rigid and somewhat inappropriate or dumb question, is he a hero or a traitor? Hero comes up easily a third to sometimes close to a half of the U.S. population. And I think that's in part a recognition of just the profoundly important information that Snowden has provided in the form of NSA documents, not only to people of this country and the entire world. And also, I think it's a recognition among many that, in effect, as I like to say, we can only have democracy if we have the informed consent of the governed. And what the people running the U.S. government want from the very top is the uninformed consent of the governed, which is not democracy at all. It's just sort of being kept in the dark and led along with a set of phony tales about what the government is or is not doing, I think that just goes to the point that whistleblowing at so many levels is so important, that whether we're talking about drone wars or subversions of democratic elected governments, whether we're talking about surveillance or Veterans Administration policies that don't give veterans the health care they need, whether we're talking about sexual abuse and harassment on college campuses, we could talk all day about the ways in which whistleblowing are absolutely essential to creating some semblance of democracy and openness in our society.
Well, Norman, recently the Al Jazeera investigative unit released this massive trove of documents that they're analyzing and publishing that they're calling the spy cables, a trove of documents from various government spy agencies, including South Africa and others. And are you heartened that the work that Snowden and Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras have done and James Risen have done has really paved the way for such media coverage of things that, you know, are considered state secrets but should get the light of day, that we are becoming more emboldened in this new age despite the crackdown from authorities?
It really is a battle between the crackdown from authorities and the capacity of whistleblowers, of civic activists, of journalists to shine light where it's got to be shined. And I am heartened very much that there is a sort of a grassroots swell of determination that we're not going to go silently, we're not going to go quietly. We don't want to be in the dark, and we don't want others to be in the dark, because it's the very basis of democratic capacities that we know what the heck our government is doing. Otherwise, we're just sort of, you know, looking at dim shadows on the cave, as the saying goes. Certainly, what Snowden did was part of the inspiration, as with what WikiLeaks has done, for the organization that you and I are on the advisory board of, and that's exposefacts.org, part of the Institute for Public Accuracy, where we have our own secure drop at exposefacts.org, inviting people to provide documents and information. And I think this sensibility is important not only for independent organizations such as exposefacts.org, but also even some mainline corporate-backed and owned media have installed their own secure drops through arrangements with the Freedom of the Press Foundation. And that's a kind of a zeitgeist that I think we need to nurture. It's absolutely a nightmare for the people running the military-industrial surveillance state that information that they're trying to keep secret from the American people would continue and increasingly reach the light of day.
And Norman, I'm wondering if you would be willing to engage in a little bit of a progressive fantasy with me. President Obama, in the last few months of his, since the GOP took over Congress, has been showing a little teeny tiny bit more of his progressive side, and wondering what the odds are that he might pardon Jeffrey Sterling and possibly drop charges against Snowden before he leaves office.
Well, it's certainly a demand that we should press. The Roots Action Petition of more than 50,000 signers urged the Justice Department to drop all charges against Jeffrey Sterling. But in terms of the chances of that happening, I think that unfortunately, not only through his personal ties with John Brennan, the head of the CIA now, but his overall sensibilities, President Obama has shown himself to have really joined himself at the hip, so to speak, with the basic CIA view of the world, of using drones and various kinds of bombing and military intervention to work Uncle Sam's will on the world. And so as much as I would like to believe that President Obama might be willing to pardon or commute the sentence of in the future of Jeffrey Sterling or pardon Edward Snowden, I think the odds are very long and very small. It's not to say we shouldn't demand it, but we need to change the politics of the country, the atmosphere in the media and Congress and elsewhere, so that at least that becomes more of an issue. In the long run, it's going to be a matter of mobilizing, because, and this I think is an important point, the extent to which we've had journalists able to safeguard the identity of confidential sources, that has come largely through civil disobedience. We have state shield laws for journalists because many journalists were willing to and did go to jail rather than betray their sources. And in a sense, James Risen was very far down the road of civil disobedience himself. And that goes to the point of whether we're a journalist or anybody else, sometimes we need to engage in civil disobedience when the system is trying to do something so wrong, as it so often does.
Well, Norman, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Norman Solomon has been my guest. He's the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, the author of War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. He's also co-founder of RootsAction.org and an editorial board member, as am I, of the organization ExposeFacts.org. We turn next to Mumia Abu-Jamal, an award-winning journalist and political prisoner who recently filed this commentary.
Feeding on fear. Every day, every night, through various media, we feed on fear. We feast on it. It matters not the measure, nor its girth. We devour it, for we cannot get enough. So-and-so is coming. ISIS threatens. And we munch our muffins of terror. The nation throws billions into government and private security and ends up more insecure than ever. New barriers are built. Cameras click on more and more street corners. More doors are locked and fear grows. Since 9/11, a kind of madness erupted in the country. And after all is said and done, all the wars, all the carnage, all the loss has led to little more than pixie dust. Nothing. Newscasts have become fear casts as government and media converge to sow dragon's teeth of fear into the minds of millions. Coming up next, new threats. The road taken by this nation after 9/11 led to this mad, fear-drenched hour. It could only have led to this, for fear can only lead to fear. It feeds governments, it fuels media, it devours reason, yet it grows, eating us as we eat it, and we are still not full. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. You can now subscribe for direct access to all our shows online at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Your subscription sustains the TV production of Uprising. It's every parent's nightmare. Your child does not come home from school or never shows up at school. There's a search, maybe Amber Alerts, media coverage, and all too often a heartbreaking discovery. But the script for what happens when a child goes missing can be dramatically different depending on the race of the missing child. For years, academics, activists, and others have noted the disproportionate response from law enforcement, politicians, and the media when a white girl is missing compared especially to a black girl. But FBI data shows that a whopping 40% of missing people are black. So pervasive is the societal blind spot on missing children of color that it even has a name among academics: missing white girl syndrome. Activists have even formed national nonprofit organizations, one named Black and Missing But Not Forgotten, another called the Black and Missing Foundation. Now, a short feature film airing on HBO highlights the ordeal of a fictional African-American family when their 15-year-old daughter goes missing and how they experience indifference from the police and the media. Muted is an award-winning film by Brandy Ford, Rachel Goldberg, and Tara Tomilchevich, which has been recognized at a number of film festivals and stars Lena Gladwell from Grey's Anatomy and my guest Danielle Watts, whose film credits include Django Unchained and who appeared on Uprising last year after an altercation that she had with the police. Welcome to Uprising. Welcome back to Uprising, Danielle.
Thank you so much for having me. It feels good. Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us. Well, can you put this film, Muted, which I had the privilege of watching yesterday and just blew me away. I was just so impressed by it. How do you put this film into the larger social and political context of how missing children are treated in our society, depending on the color of their skin?
I feel like it's an ongoing conversation about how we can become more aware of the racism that exists in our society and how that fundamentally filters into all different areas of media, politics, government, law enforcement, and how that affects our perception as the media relays it to the public. And I think that's something that changes over time, but it's definitely becoming more clear and clear as people are taking to YouTube and making their own movies and getting that news out there saying, look, we deserve to have our stories heard and recognized.
In many ways, this is sort of a very little talked about story in the news. I mean, as I mentioned, academics have been following this, noting the strong disparity in how people are treated in the media and law enforcement. And activists themselves in the African-American community have formed organizations, have formed networks to try to do something to help themselves because nobody seems to be giving enough help. But it's not covered very much in the media. And so I'm wondering, like, essentially the storyline of the film, a 15-year-old African-American girl who you play, Crystal, goes missing, doesn't show up home. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's the predictable heartbreak. I think nobody except someone who's actually been through it really knows what it feels like as a parent to have your child not show up. And then police have a very different take. The sense is that, well, if it's a white child who goes missing, they're innocent, something bad must have happened to them. But if a black child goes missing, they're probably up to no good.
Yeah, well, it's hard to really speak to it unless you've been through it. You know, it's like one of those situations where having been through, just speaking personally, being through a situation recently where I've noticed the stereotypes that have been projected about me on a massive scale through the mainstream media, and then realizing that people relate to you completely differently because they totally believe that that is the truth. So, you know, people think, oh, well, she must be, you know, this sort of person who's having sex in her car just because a cop goes on TV and says that I was lying, even though the media doesn't cover the fact that the cop is currently under investigation and he's going to be fired. I mean, let's remind our listeners
what happened last year. Yeah. Some of our viewers and listeners may remember from when we had you on our program last year. Essentially, you were detained temporarily, not formally arrested, by a police officer not too far away from where we're recording. And I understand that there was a perception that he assumed you were a sex worker. And you made a big stink about it instead of keeping quiet about it, which is perhaps what he might have expected you to do. And you Facebooked it, you spoke out about it, and then got slammed in the media for overreacting. But your experience, of course, is very similar to the sort of dehumanization that many black women and young girls get in our media.
Yeah, and so for me, speaking out about how I honestly felt, even though that may not have made me very popular with people, I think was what was important. And looking at how that relates to, for example, missing children, and speaking out about, look, you know, maybe my kid may not be perfect, but that doesn't mean that they're not as valuable as perhaps a white kid who goes missing. However, I think the media, the mainstream media, they look at numbers and they look at, you know, the perhaps white women who have the privilege of staying home, who don't have to work. That's their target audience. Those are the people that they're sort of gearing the news towards. So they're using fear, oh, if a white child goes missing, then we're going to pay attention to the news more because, you know, that's their target audience. Those are the people who are staying home to watch the news while many minorities have to work and they have to, you know, be gone. So they're not so maybe so much gearing the news towards.
I think you're being kinder to the media than I would be. I think there's also the sense that Black children are less innocent, and we should just come out and say that, right? There was a study done recently where police officers were shown photos of, in this case, boys, African-American boys, and they routinely and consistently overestimated the ages of Black boys compared to white boys. And so there's this perception, this is part of our implicit bias that we hold. The Justice Department just did a study on Ferguson, Missouri, where they found just rampant implicit bias, well, rampant racial bias in both communications as well as arrest records of the police there. Mm-hmm. And that's part and parcel of it, right?
Yes. And I think speaking out about it is difficult because you don't want to be, waving the victim flag. Right. But at the same time, there are real issues and real conversations, you know, that radio stations like this, you guys have all the time. But the mainstream media, I think, on some level thinks that they're not digestible for the general public. But I think that's changing. I think with the internet and with, you know, things being people being able to take their own stories and make them public, I think more and more people are saying we don't need the mainstream news anymore to get our stories across. Let's get them across in our own way. And that's what I'm hoping for, you know, with a film like this, which came from a film festival, you know, won the prize at a film festival and then got to be seen on HBO because it won the prize at the American Black Film Festival. So, you know, these sort of channels that can help bring it to the mainstream in a way that people can digest and sort of feel into why somebody might be so upset, you know, because a police officer or a media is relating to them a certain way, and kind of understand that emotional context a little bit more and feel it more deeply.
So let's talk a little bit more about the film. And actually, can you explain the title of the film, Muted?
Muted, yeah. It relates to, I think, the idea that this story, this feeling, this troubling problem is not being heard by society. So there's a deep frustration there. And then when the media finally pays attention in the film, they show up at the end of the film. She's distraught. Her child is gone. It's been weeks. You know, there's nothing she can do at that point. And the media only picks it up when she's the angry Black woman at that point. So then it then serves to reinforce this idea that Black women are angry for no reason and, you know, they're overreacting when really it's a systematic sort of oppression of, like, what happens to a dream deferred that has to explode. So by the time the mainstream media catches on, the Black people or the brown people or the minorities are angry. They're upset when if we could catch on a little sooner and sort of feel into these stories when they're, you know, as they're happening, then it doesn't reach this explosive point. But I think on many levels, we're already at that explosive point. So on some levels, we have to accept that anger is a part of that process. If you're going to be muted for such a long time and the you know, consequence for speaking up is that, you know, you get shamed on so many levels, then at certain point, the anger's got to come out, you know, because that's part of the process of reconciliation and coming to clarity.
Well, the scenes that in the film, particularly of Lena Gladwell, who plays your mother in this film, Muted, the horror, the unimaginable anguish that a mother goes through. You know, she'd had an argument with her child right before the child goes missing, as teenage mm-hmm. girls and mothers do. Yeah. And just these solitary scenes where she's calling up members of the media, asking them to cover her missing daughter, were just really incredible. And can you also tell us about the scene where the family of the missing girl who you play sits up when the TV is turned on, yeah. and they think they're hearing the media covering the story of the missing girl. What happened?
Yeah, so they've been waiting, just on eggshells for some news, for some response, and they finally hear about a missing child on the news, and it turns out that it's actually a young white girl who has just gone missing. Very similar circumstances. Last seen walking home from school. And there's sort of this incredulous response. You see it wash over their faces going, wow, am I not human? Am I not valuable? And as you were saying, Chandra Wilson, you know, from Grey's Anatomy, who plays Lena Gladwell, my mother, she you can feel that in her emotions. She's so sort of trying to process and digest how she could be so easily dismissed. And you can feel almost like she might take it personally, like, is it something I did? Like, maybe I didn't pay enough attention, you know? She starts to doubt herself as a mother. Maybe I wasn't a good mother. Maybe I didn't give my child enough. So there's this whole emotional conflict that she has to wade through based on stereotypes that are projected onto her as a mother, as a Black mother, you know, and it's complex, you know, it's emotional and it's complex.
And thank you for that correction, Chandra Wilson from Grey's Anatomy, and the name of her character, Lena Gladwell, in this film, Muted. And it's interesting, I'm looking into this issue and that this film brings up. I'm also reminded of the story of the Grim Sleeper in this case in South Los Angeles of hundreds of missing, mostly young Black women. And it took decades for the police and the media to catch on that there was this enormous tragedy that nobody was willing to do, you know, enough about. Now there's a man on trial for the murders. There was this wonderful documentary about it recently called Tales of the Grim Sleeper. Many thought it might get an Oscar nod, but it didn't. Mm-hmm. And this sort of leads me to this question of that we were touching on earlier, how films like Muted have had to have a circuitous route to a platform like HBO. We recently saw the whitest Oscar ceremony that we've seen in many, many decades, launching a Twitter campaign, Oscars So White, hashtag Oscars So White. And I'm wondering, you know, all of these things are part of the same problem, right? The dehumanization of young Black girls and women in particular, media and police apathy, and also rejection from Hollywood, or just essentially, you know, not a very welcome place for Black made films about Black issues, etc.
Well, yes, and I feel like it's changing along with the tide of how people are digesting content. You know, if anyone can take a camera in their hands and make a movie and project that to their friends and share it through the internet, then I feel like it devalues the Oscars. So yes, we're paying attention to them going, what's going on? What's going on? Why is there no diversity? At a certain point, people will just stop paying attention to these old and dying systems that dehumanize and devalue people, and we'll you know, the whole system, I think, is crumbling and changing. The studio system is crumbling and changing, and along with it goes the Academy. I'm not daunted by those systems. Otherwise, I wouldn't be in Hollywood trying to be an actor. I mean, I'm still pushing on, creating work, doing projects like this that say, look, we don't need the approval of these old systems to get out there. We're going to do it anyway.
I'm also reminded of the social media campaign last year when celebrities all over the U.S., including First Lady Michelle Obama, rightly drew attention to the hundreds of missing Nigerian girls kidnapped by Boko Haram. And that was a huge story. Bring Back Our Girls was that campaign. But there are thousands of missing Black women and girls here in the United States, literally tens of thousands. 40%, I mentioned, of the FBI's data suggesting that 40%, almost 40% of all missing people are African American. I mean, this is huge compared to the percentage of the population. No one's talking about that. I don't see the protests here from celebrities, even from Michelle Obama.
And that's why I'm here, you know, because if I can lend my voice to it in a positive way, that to say, look, it's not waving a victim flag. It's not angry for no reason. There is a real disparity here. And if we talk about it and share it, then this discussion starts to build to a resonance that people can actually digest it and realize that it's real. It's not just something that minorities are making up to wave the victim flag, you know, because I think that's part of the shame that goes along with it. You think if you speak out about something, you know, these families that are going through the hardest thing that you can possibly imagine, they think, oh, well, on some level, I deserve this, because we're so conditioned by this dehumanizing idea of what it means to be Black or brown in this country, in this society. And so through talking about it, we can release that shame and say, look, my life is just as valuable as anyone else's, and I'm going to speak up about it.
And I think this issue of humanity and humanizing is crucial here. You know, we see on our TV screens and on the big screen how white people are constantly humanized. They feel, they hurt, they, you know, they have complexity, they have nuance. And Black characters and in general characters of color, but I think especially African-American characters, you don't get that humanity. And in this film, Muted, you know, it's so rare to just see the anguish of a Black mother. And I'm wondering if you think that that's really the issue here that your film, you're hoping, will address, to humanize the pain a Black mother goes through.
Exactly. I think that when you see her performance, it's undeniable. You can't help but feel what she's going through. And that's what the arts are all about, to sort of infuse this empathy into the public sphere, to be a mirror and say, yes, there's politics, there's government, but there's real humans within this structure that feel real things. And that's what creates, you know, sort of these ripples. I mean, if there wasn't a history of Black people being considered less than human in this country, literally on the books, you know, that dehumanization wouldn't affect anyone's psyche in an emotional context. But it's literally laws written out on the books saying Black people are less than human, and that has ripple effects that transpire in very complex ways. And if we can become aware of that through our emotions, then we can really feel it and make change, because we feel it. We're inspired to make change because of our feelings.
And there's never, of course, truly been a historical reckoning or reconciliation in this country like there has at least attempted to have one in South Africa, for example, with apartheid there. We've never really had a formal reconciliation process. And I'm wondering if the Black Lives Matter movement that began last year and some of the conversations that digital technology is enabling us to have may at some point bring that up. And I'm also reminded of the actor David Oyelowo, who recently is playing Martin Luther King Jr. in Selma, an incredible film that was snubbed by the Oscars, recently made a statement to the effect of, there's only certain kinds of roles that African-Americans, when they play in movies, get recognized for. And I'm wondering, as an actress yourself, do you face a conundrum in terms of wanting to obviously get work and a limited set of roles that are available to you?
I think anyone that I've ever been inspired by as far as a pioneer or as far as an activist has said, you create what you want to see. And if you hold that vision so tightly, there's nothing that can stop you. And that's what I have to tell myself, because otherwise I would be, you know, I would be frustrated all the time
depressed
and I wouldn't be here right now. I'd be in my room crying. You know, there's this optimism in me that says, you know, that if you want to make it, you're going to make it. You're going to find your voice, and you're going to do everything you can to get that out there so that other people can see themselves reflected in your art. So that means complex stories where it's not just suffering and pain, but it's also light and it's also dark. And there's you know, the characters aren't always perfect, where they're not always role models. You know, Black and brown people are not all perfect. And I think that adds to the complexity. But we have all these stereotypes that are like mines that we're sort of wading through, you know, so it makes sense that so many of the Black projects that are out there have to do with the representing proud images of what it means to be Black. But I think that can also be an oppressive force too, because we're human. So we're all things, you know, and we're...
Nobody is perfect.
Nobody's perfect, you know, and that's what I relate to deeply, you know, when, you know, the civil rights leaders denounced me and said, well, she's not a good representation of the Black community, I really had to look inside and go, you know what? I am representing humanity. And so, yes, I am Black, but I'm representing this story of what the capability of what humanity can be. And people can either accept that or they can find another role model. Fine, you know, but for me, I'm going to do my best to bring, you know, the love that's in my heart and the passion and the clarity of my own experience to whatever that is. And that's messy and complicated, but ultimately we're trying to, you know, break down some of those walls of communication so that these understandings can come through in a deeper way. And I think film is a powerful tool to do that. And
right. And we should say so-called civil rights leaders, maybe. So finally, what are some of the projects that you're working on? And also, is it an exciting time to be in the film industry as a young African-American to have these avenues that 10, 20 years ago weren't available to people to be able to, if a major studio snubs you to, enter it into a festival, get it, on another platform. There are some films that are being made for online audiences alone. There are TV shows being made for online audiences alone that are generating greater numbers than even traditional.
Well, that's the benefit of education, because I'm aware of the history. So that gives me such a deep appreciation for what we have now compared to what my dad had. It's just night and day. So I'm very appreciative of being here at this time. I have a film that's premiering at South by Southwest called The Babysitter, which is complex. It's about a white guy and a black girl, and she's older, and she's the family's babysitter, and it's messy. It raises issues of this complexity of these people who aren't perfect, but it's being shown at a major festival, and it was made by my friend. It's these avenues are breaking down, and I feel like if I put my focus there on all there is to appreciate about, being able to express myself at this point in history compared to other points in history, it's all good, because it's very inspiring to see that there are so many avenues to present your work, and that's a blessing that I just, I can't help but feel thankful for.
And so finally, Muted, the film that we started this conversation mm-hmm. around, showing, I believe, this month on HBO?
Yes, on HBO Go, and there are several showings in March. If you have HBO, you can look that up, mm-hmm. and I know that they're planning to develop it into a full feature.
Wow.
So if you go to mutedthemovie.com, you can get more information about how you can support them, because I think a full feature would help to get the story out there in a broader way, for people to really feel into this disparity with missing black girls and help bring that to light.
That's mutedthemovie.com. And my guest, Danielle Watts, plays the role of Crystal, a 15-year-old girl who goes missing. Chandra Wilson playing the role of her mother. She's, of course, famous from her role in Grey's Anatomy and the film made by Brandy Ford, Rachel Goldberg, and Tara Tomaljevic. I want to thank you so much for joining us. I should say this is a women-run film. This
yes.
is a women's project, too, which is also fantastic.
Yes.
And we need more women's films. This is Women's History Month. Thank you so much.
Beautiful. Thank you.
My guest, Danielle Watts, is an actress who stars in a short film called Muted, just released on HBO. This is Uprising. Bipasha Shom is our senior producer. Anna Buss is our assistant producer. Christian Beck is our production assistant. And Alexander Holmes is our technical director. Federico Garcia, Kiana Turner, and Jonathan Alexander are our audio engineers, and Annie Mendoza is our social media coordinator. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. I'll see you tomorrow.